us on and where the pointer is, so we're all set.
First of all, before I get into some of the lessons that have been learned and some of the operational and transmission issues that are important to integrating wind in South Dakota and in the rest of the country, I want to say a few words of background about the AWCC and its work. This slide here talks about the mission of the AWCC, or the vision, which is commercial wind power markets that are environmentally, economically, and politically sustainable. And that vision has really provided the framework for the activities of the NWCC over the last 14 years that Abby spoke about. One of the really powerful things about the NWCC, and just speaking to a few people this morning about what attracted them to the agenda, is the range of participants that we have in the NWCC activities. It's really a very broad cross-section of stakeholders that's represented, and the NWCC has a very good reputation as an objective, unbiased organization that works on dispute resolution, which is the background that Abby and Katie come from, which has been very helpful in identifying and helping to resolve the transmission issues. But you look at the range of sectors up there, electric utilities, state legislatures, utility commissions, state utility commissions, consumer advocates, the wind industry, environmental organizations. It's really quite a range of interests represented. And overall, the NWCC helps to identify issues that are important to achieving this vision of wind power, establishing dialogue among key stakeholders, and then trying to identify and resolve the issues that have been raised. And that's, of course, a very beneficial way to get things done rather than waiting until issues turn into problems and they end up in litigation instead of in some kind of a negotiation. Now, you mentioned two major activities or work groups of the NWCC, wildlife and electric transmission. There's also some other activities that the NWCC has been involved with over the years, including siting, economic development, and issue forums. Really, the primary product, and those of you who have been to these meetings before know that there's a tremendous amount of value that comes out of the dialogue that's established, not only established in these meetings, but the dialogue that continues after the meetings are over among the different people, different sectors that are represented. In the transmission arena, I think a very good example key activities or a key activity that was catalyzed through an NWCC meeting here in the upper Midwest area was the identification of wind production zones for the MISO transmission expansion planning. Came out of one of these meetings, it was identified that one of the groups working in this area, one of the advocacy groups, Wind on the Wires, which is represented here today with Beth and Matt, worked together with the wind developers to provide a very good picture of what the wind development would look like over time in MISO. Very helpful in doing the MISO transmission expansion plan. Documents, websites, as we mentioned, nationalwind.org, a very good website for not only the transmission but the wildlife, economic development activities that we've worked on over the years. The transmission work group scope is similar to that of the overall organization in that it provides a forum to help identify issues, help identify alternatives to resolve the issues, and then work on building consensus for actual solutions to the issues that have been identified. Also, information that's provided. Again, the website is a good place to find that. And monitoring FERC activities and engagement with FERC. It's been FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It's a national body that is very much involved with interstate commerce in the transmission and sets the rules and regulations that deal with how transmission costs are spread and how they're recovered. Critical question for building more transmission for the future. And Abby is usually pretty good at reminding me to speak in non-engineering language, and I'm going to try hard to remember that here because I use a lot of abbreviations and jargon, I guess, accumulated over the years. Yeah. There was a very good study that was done here in the upper Midwest, finished about a year ago, looking at the costs of integrating wind in the MISO footprint. MISO is heavily involved in the study, ran a lot of the analytical tools that we use. And what I have here is a chart that shows the cost, the incremental cost of integrating wind compared to some other resource in dollars per megawatt hour of wind energy generated as a function of the percentage penetration of wind energy into the total electric energy production. And you can see the costs here range from a dollar $1 to $4.50 a megawatt hour at penetrations ranging from 15% to 20% to 25%. It was pretty much a surprise to the people that were involved in the study. Many people were expecting to see larger costs for the wind integration based on previous studies that had been done. But there are a couple of unique features of the MISO footprint. One of those is the fact that it does operate a large market over a broad geographical region. And the other is that it is a single large balancing area. So all of the variations in the load generation and the wind generation in particular are aggregated across a very broad footprint.
Can you explain what MISO
is? I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that one out. MISO, Midwest Independent System Operator. It's one of about a half a dozen independent grid operators that operates the transmission network in the upper Midwest. I have a map a little later that shows the footprint. It also designs and operates the markets, the electricity markets, day-ahead market, real-time market, and soon to be an ancillary service market. Ancillary services are the services that are provided to maintain a system balance between the load and the generation. It's been in existence for probably 4 or 5 years. I think we'll hear several speakers, Dale Osborne and Claire Moeller from MISO, over the course of the next day. One of the major sources of cost that's associated with the integration of wind is dealing with the additional variability in the net load that has to be met and the additional uncertainty in that net load because of the uncertainty in the wind plant output. And this chart from the study shows for the three different cases, 15, 20, and 25% wind, the different categories of reserves that have to be carried and how they vary from the base case of no wind up to the 25% wind. And as you look down here and compare the base case with the 25% case, you see that the major additional increase in reserve and in cost is in the operating reserve that has to be kept to deal with the additional uncertainty in the hour ahead or 2 hours ahead time frame. Within the hour, where the reserves are a little more expensive to carry, there's really not much additional increase in cost, which is a surprise to a lot of people. And I'll show you another graph that kind of illustrates the reason for that. One of the important things to point out, too, I think, is that the contingency reserve, the spinning and non-spinning reserves, for both the base case and the very high penetration case are the same. And that's because those reserves are there to provide for the single largest contingency that is planned for in this region, and that is the loss of a tie to Manitoba Hydro. And the addition of about 6,000 megawatts of wind in that case didn't change the single largest contingency of 1,500 megawatts because there's no credible single contingency where you lose all of the wind at the same time. It's spread across a very large area, and because of the weather patterns, you don't expect to lose anywhere near that amount of wind, even with a large storm going through in a short period of time. That was kind of an interesting thing to observe. I told you I would take a look at the aggregation effects of large balancing areas. And this is a graph that from my friend Thomas Ackerman. And it looks at the impact of aggregating the output of wind turbines in the seconds time frame. This is seconds across the horizontal axis and the megawatts of output on the vertical axis, looking at a single wind turbine, then 30 wind turbines, then 150 wind turbines, and 300 wind turbines. So this is a snapshot of the same period of time. And a lot of people have knowledge of wind turbine output based on the output of a single machine. You can see that it just really jumps all over the place. But then as you start aggregating that output together of more and more turbines over a larger area, in this case going up to 300 turbines, you put 300 of those turbines together and look at their output, and it's a very much different picture. And that's really the power of aggregation and the reason that large control areas are a whole lot easier to deal with, make it a whole lot easier to deal with a lot of wind than a small single control area.
Can I just explain why you are going to care about the traditional resources have a constant flow?
Yeah. I'd be asked to say a word about why operators care about this. And the reason is that the system has to be kept in balance. There always has to be a balance between the load and the generation. And if your generation, utilities are used to dealing with a fairly constant output generation that's controllable. The output of the wind plant is not controllable. It's based on the speed at which the wind is blowing. So the system always has to be kept in balance. And you'd like to have a behavior. behavior of the wind plant that is more smooth, that's easier to balance, you know, the variations that take place in the second-to-second, minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour time frame. And aggregation gives you a much easier balancing problem than very small control areas where you have a lot more variability to deal with than you have in the large control area. We're going to talk about three time scales of interest. These are time scales that utility operators are usually dealing with. The regulation time frame, which is the changes that take place in the few seconds to a minute or so. The load following time scale, changes that take place from, you know, tens of minutes to a couple hours, kind of the ramps that happen within the hours. This is a daily load shape for 24 hours. Load is low at night, picks up in the daytime, falls down in the afternoon, maybe it's an evening peak, and it falls off at night. These are an example of a seven-day kind of load curve. And the time scale of interest for the longer time frame is scheduling or unit commitment, where utilities have to look day ahead, a few days ahead, make sure that they've got sufficient generation available to meet the expected loads that they are planning on over that period of time. And when we look at the costs that are associated with integrating wind in those three different time scales, what I have here is a list of number of studies that have been done over the last 3 or 4 years. The wind capacity penetration, or the percentage of wind nameplate capacity compared to the peak load in the system. These three different time scales, regulation, load following, and unit commitment. It's kind of hard to compare from study to study, but basically what you see is that the regulation and load following costs within the hour are not very large. It's really the costs in the hours ahead, the unit commitment cost time frame, that are driving the wind integration costs. And we see costs or penetrations up to a 20 to 30%, ranging up to $4 or $5 a megawatt hour. And the results of these studies are pretty consistent, whether you're looking in the United States or around the world. Similar sorts of results are found for the wind integration studies in Denmark, Spain, and Germany, three countries that were mentioned as having very high wind penetrations in Europe. In addition to the behavior of the aggregated turbines, there's also technology advances being made in the single turbines that are very important to helping to balance the system and to
making it easier to operate a system with a lot of wind on it. This is a capabilities for Vestas machines, but they're similar for GE machines and other vendors. Active power control, if you look at the red line is the output of the turbine or the wind plant. The green line is the output that's possible
if the wind turbine or wind plant were allowed to run at whatever output would be provided by the prevailing wind.
So you can control the output of a wind plant, you can cut it back,
hold it to some level.
You can control the rate at which the output of the wind plant is changing.
Under certain conditions, system operators are very concerned about the rate of change of wind plant output because, as I said, it's got to be balanced, the load and the generation has to be balanced. So if the wind plant output were going up very rapidly, some other plant would have to be coming down to keep the system down.
Active power control or delta control, where you can actually operate the wind plant at some fixed megawatts below what the available output is.
In other words, carry spinning reserve on the wind plant. It comes at a cost because you're spilling
wind to do that. And also participate in frequency control, such that if the system frequency goes down, you can raise the output of the wind plant if you're carrying reserve in the delta power control mode, or you can always increase the output or decrease the output of the wind plant if the frequency is going up. Wind plant output forecasting is very important. What I have here is a
result of a wind plant forecasting system in Denmark. This cloud that you see moving across the
chart here is a picture of the expected output of the wind plant as a function of time, and this goes out for about
3 days ahead.
And as you can see, in the first day, the expected band of variation is just fairly small, down in the, 20, 40, 60, 80, 100%. You get out 2 or 3 days ahead, and the variations
in the wind plant output are much larger. So what this tells you is that you'd like to be doing frequent updates to your forecast. You'd like to have as small a band of error as possible to minimize the variability and the uncertainty associated with the load that you're trying to meet as a system operator.
And there's a bunch of colored curves on here. You'll see a curve on the top, like the red curve. That was the highest
one of the forecasts, there's about like 100 forecasts that were run in a probabilistic sort of way, changing a bunch of input variables
to try to give you a high forecast, a low forecast, there's a median, there's an average, there's a most likely forecast, and then there's the actual wind gone back and superimposed in this black curve here. And you can see that there's still advances to be made in wind plant outlook forecasting. They can do it pretty well, you know, close in, but there's still room for improvement. But even given that, the kinds of mean absolute errors that are talked about in the day-ahead time frame are 20% errors for single plants and maybe 8% errors for large collections of plants. It's good, but it's not perfect. It's getting better. I think I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. An energy resource in a capacity world.
A lot of conversation around the topic that, well, you can't count on the wind plant. It's not there when you need it. Well, I think that it's very important when you're talking about wind to understand that wind is an energy resource. It's not a capacity resource. You put in wind because you want to get clean, low carbon source of energy in a carbon constrained world. And you recognize when you put it in that it is a source of energy that you can't plan on its output. You're displacing energy, you're not displacing capacity. And wind plants are very seldom, if ever, put in to provide capacity for a system. Once the system is, and once you put the wind plants into the system, you still have to do the job as a system planner of providing for a reliable system by making sure that there's sufficient capacity available to meet the system peak load. Very important distinction to make, understand the difference between an energy resource and a capacity resource. And there's different thinking, there's different transmission planning techniques that I'm sure you'll hear about later in the next 2 days that apply to energy resources as opposed to capacity resources.
This chart shows the results of a number of wind integration studies that have been done that have examined the capacity value.
You look at what the likelihood is of having some output from the wind plant during the time of system peak load. The so-called ELCC, or effective load carrying capability, kind of the dependable capacity of a wind plant. And
studies that have been done for a number of different locations find numbers that range everywhere from about 5% up to about 40%. These first two here for the NYSERDA study that was done by GE back in 2004, 2005 are very interesting. One is for an offshore wind plant off of Long Island. The other is for an onshore wind plant really spread across the entire state. I've forgotten that. The first one is the onshore, the second one is the offshore.
The onshore wind plant had a capacity value of about 10%. And the output of the wind plant was pretty much out of phase with the load curve.
The offshore wind plant had a capacity value of about 40%,
which said that the output of the wind plant was much more in phase with the load. And just think about it, the offshore wind plant was off the coast of Long Island. You get these afternoon sea breezes when the output of the wind plant would pick up just as the load was picking up, so it was much more in phase with the load, so it had more value from a capacity point of view.
I'm going to say a few words about transmission
issues in relation to this 20% wind energy vision that Steve Lindenberg from DOE is going to be talking about in just a few minutes.
This study was done, and one of the things
we looked at what 20% of our energy nationwide coming from wind energy would look like. And one of the critical things that was realized in the opening remarks by the Lieutenant Governor, and it'll be talked about in the next couple of days, is that you'll never achieve a lot of wind in the energy mix without having more transmission. Transmission is critical to get the wind energy from where it is to where it needs to be used.
And as part of this 20% vision study, a conceptual 765 kV transmission system overlay was done by AEP, which would provide something like 200 to 400 gigawatts of ability to integrate or deliver additional capacity to the load, an investment of something like $60 billion over the next 20 years
for about 19,000 miles of transmission line.
Where we are right now in South Dakota, I guess we're somewhere over here, you can see that these are the three interconnections, the eastern interconnection, the western interconnection, the ERCOT, and broken up by the reliability regions. This is a whole another set of terms and structure, I guess, that's and it's part of the NERC world, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation now. So South Dakota is in the MRO, but if you go and take a look at the market regions in North America, and MISO market is this green area here, look at South Dakota, you can see that South Dakota really is not in the MISO market. And that's a critical factor in being able to generate and deliver energy to load, is to be part of a market. I showed that MISO study, the Midwest Wind Integration Study, the MISO market was critical to keeping the wind energy integration costs down and being able to deliver the energy to load and provide the ancillary services that are required. So as you saw from the agenda, we're going to be talking a lot about the seams issues and about the market issues associated with South Dakota in the next day.
Can you tell us what seams issues are, please?
Seams, wherever those, you see two different colors up there, there's a seam. It's the boundaries between the different markets areas. Market, and there's different rules on each side of the boundaries, and so there's seams between them, and a lot of time and attention goes to trying to resolve those seams issues. So this is the conceptual EHV overlay that AEP did, and again, if you look, it's not meant to be indicative. It's not the solution to the wind integration problem. It's just a conceptual look at the kind of transmission that would be required to achieve the 20% wind vision, which is about 300 gigawatts of wind nationwide. And again, you look at South Dakota here, this isn't the be-all and end-all of the transmission map, but you can see there's the green lines of the 765, there's a couple of major lines crisscrossing the state and some major loops that go around the state. And it's also part of some of the work you'll be hearing about from MISO, how you would move the energy from South Dakota to the load centers, which are further east in Chicago and all the way to the East Coast. Two things I want to say quickly about the transmission logjam. One is that there's some very exciting things going on in Texas and California. In Texas, you've probably heard about the CREZ, the Competitive Renewable Energy Zones. It's an idea of identifying resource-rich areas like South Dakota and saying, Mr. Wind Developer, if you want to build wind plants, there's a renewable energy zone out here, and if you put your plant in that area, we're going to build the transmission from that renewable energy zone to the load centers. It's a little easier to do in Texas because Texas is not regulated by the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, because it's not interconnected synchronously to the rest of the system. It's got DC ties. So it's easier to do, but it's serving as an inspiration, I think, to other states who are looking to accomplish the same thing. And California is one of those states, and it has about 5,000 megawatts in Tehachapi. It adopted a slightly different look at this. Instead of calling it a CREZ, they call that zone the wind in that zone a locationally constrained resource. And then they devised a hit. You like that, huh? So they devised a way of creating a case to build transmission to a locationally constrained resource. And there's some very creative filings and work that's going on in California to make that happen. Basically, it's been approved by FERC and hopefully will be a model for other areas of the country. Just looking at some recent electric transmission weekly headlines. Transmission is in the news everywhere you look. At the national level, Senator Reid from Nevada introduced this bill to name renewable energy zones and finance transmission lines. I think there's a corresponding piece of legislation that's been introduced in the House. That's taking note at a national level of the kind of thing that's happening in Texas and California. California now has this renewable energy transmission initiative, similarly looking at other zones within the state that could be renewable energy zones and where transmission could be built. The Western Energy Summit, I think that Abby, or maybe the Lieutenant Governor, mentioned that there was a Midwest Governors Association meeting and a platform that came out of that recognized the opportunities for wind energy in the Midwest and the need to build transmission to unlock the wind energy and get it to market. And then AEP and Mid-American, AEP, the owner of
the only and the largest 765 kV system in the country, about 2,000 miles of 765 line. Create a second joint venture to build transmission. So transmission's everywhere. I want to wrap up by just summarizing system planning and operations recommendations that have come out of studies that have been done around the U.S. that apply equally to South Dakota. I won't go through all of them, but I've mentioned most of them: performing detailed wind integration studies, getting more flexibility in the balance of plants, aggregating output over large areas, consolidating balancing areas, very important things to do to make a favorable environment for integrating wind on the transmission planning front. Getting adequate transmission capacity, absolutely critical. Comprehensive regional planning processes. I think you're really lucky in MISO to have one of those processes already in place here. Some federal leadership, particularly organizations like WAPIC and DPA, for getting transmission built. There's some pretty wind-rich but very low population density areas. Transmission financing, we'll be hearing more about that in the next couple of days. Market operation and transmission policy, well-functioning markets, real-time markets, hour-ahead markets, day-ahead markets, absolutely critical. It's a lesson that's being learned all over the world. There's nothing like markets of increasingly shorter gate closure time, if you will, that allow the imbalances and the wind differences between the actual and the forecast to be traded. And balance of the systems being maintained. Market rules, tariff provisions, that's a FERC-related thing. FERC has been very helpful in that regard, I think, in eliminating imbalance penalties that have applied in the past. Some new transmission products and eliminating pancake rates is a function of MISO footprint already. And to sum it all up, there's really no fundamental technical barriers to why much higher wind energy penetrations, 20%, can't be achieved, but they're not going to be achieved under a business-as-usual scenario. There's things that have to be done: evolutions of system operation policy, transmission planning policy, and market development to enable that to happen. The end.